afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addisk, to bring you our opinion, our commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Tuesday. It is the 27th of December. We are live today. This is not a rebroadcast. 2016. A couple more days left of the year. Good afternoon, Al.
Well, Melody, I'm rebroadcasting. You may not be, but
you're
I am.
Okay, you're a replay?
Uh-huh.
You're a replay?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm live. You can be the alternative. Anyway, welcome back, Al. It's good to be here. I missed the program.
Yep, so do I.
I missed the program not doing it, but sometimes you just need a couple of days just to get this good old feeling back that you actually missed doing the program and talking with clients all day. So I enjoyed it. I hope everyone had a wonderful holiday. Merry Christmas. This my favorite day of the year.
Which is?
January.
Christmas or the day after? Oh,
January.
January 2nd.
January 2nd.
Get done with the holidays.
Back to my routine.
You know, we're just having too much fun sometimes in the holidays, therefore, let's get back to work.
No, I just enjoy my routine. And when I'm out of my routine, it's just things just don't work. So I like my routine. Gold liked its routine for today anyway. It was up right now in the New York spot aftermarket, up $10.30 at 1139.60, off the high by a couple bucks. We'll take 1139.60. Silver had a tough and go for 16.1603. Currently up 0.18. Platinum down a buck. I mean, sometimes it makes you wonder how it can just be down a buck when it's $906. $906 for platinum. Palladium had a good day, almost 3%. $677 up point or up 19. The USDX today. 0.10 to the upside at 103.04. Crude oil was up 0.86 at 53.88. And I'm pretty sure everyone knows, again, the U.S. stocks are trading near a record. And a little pressure on the treasuries today. The Dow was up 11 points. Off its high, though, 19,945. NASDAQ was up 24 at 5,487. The S&P was up 5 at 2,268. 10-year yield up 0.02 at 2.56. So they were up. And I believe in addition to the UK financial markets in Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, all of those markets were closed today. So whatever reasons they might be, they are closed for the day. I'm not sure. I would assume they were going to reopen tomorrow. But there was also a consumer report out today, and there's a lot of optimism out there about the stock market. It registered a dramatic one-month surge. The last time this optimism was this high, and that was during the dot-com boom. Remember the dot-com boom, Al?
Before my time, Melody.
Well, I remember, and I remember how quickly it dropped, and I remember how quickly so many people lost their funds. As stocks have reached a record, the share of households anticipating higher equity prices a year from now surged to 44% in December from 30.9% just a month earlier. This is actually the biggest monthly advance since November of 1998, and this was all part of the Conference Board's report on consumer confidence. The group's overall measure of sentiment rose this month to the highest level since August of 2001. Consumer confidence climbed in December to the highest, let's go down to the numbers. Confidence index increased to 113.7. Everyone was forecasting 109. In November, it was 109.4. So, Economists were actually expecting it to drop off a tad. Instead, it boomed to 113. The measure of consumer expectations for the next 6 months rose to 105.5. This is the highest since December of 2003. And so American households, they are expecting the new administration to deliver. They are more upbeat about the prospects for the economy, labor markets, and their incomes. This is all according to the Conference Board's reports. And a lot of optimism out there. We saw the post-election
surge. Yeah, there is in places. There is in places. But here's another article from Reuters. And it's the headline is Stock Pickers Nursing Losses Despite Bull Run, Despite Markets Bull Run, looked at 2017. Financial pundits shouted about the record high levels of the stock market in 2016. For actively managed stock mutual funds, there was another record, one they would rather keep quiet, the largest amount of net withdrawals ever recorded, meaning a whole lot of people got out of mutual funds. U.S.-based activity-managed stock funds suffered $288 billion in withdrawals year-to-date through November, the largest on record. This is according to Thomson Reuters Lipper Service. The figure tops the outflows of $139 billion in 2015 and $218 billion in 2008 at the onset of the financial crisis. In the United States, bond prices fell on fears that Trump's promises to cut taxes and financial regulations could unleash inflation, the bane of fixed income markets. So, I don't know. There's some goes up and some goes down, but a lot of people are bailing out of hedge funds, mutual funds, excuse me. And what does that mean, Melody? Is that evidence of some sort of optimism or confidence, or is it evidence that some people are saying there's something wrong here?
Well, I think they're moving their money around, but if they're pulling it out and putting it in the, in cash and so forth. But what it also tells me is that you're, I'm sure it has a lot to do with bonds too, because there's been a lot of trading on bonds. What this tells me is the investors, the professionals, I should say, know what they're doing. When you're looking at these consumer sentiments, you're looking at the American people. And it's the American people that are always a day late. A day late and a dollar short. So what this tells me is, you're seeing money move around professionally, but yet the American out there, he's just going along with what he's being told, and he's going to fall for it, hook, line, and sinker, and he will be the one that loses the most, and it will be harder for him to recapture what he's lost. People are getting older, and so it's a little bit harder to get those returns back that you have lost. So, this to me is a sign, and that's what I wanted to talk about, the consumer sentiment, particularly because we're comparing it with 1997, 1998, 2001, 2004. What all happened right after those dates? Market crashes. So again, we have the most highest sentiment confidence, which tells me we're peaking, folks. It's that simple. And again, what this will tell you, what to expect for next year. And I don't believe that the U.S. holiday spending exceeded $1 trillion. Maybe it did. How do we know? We don't have any numbers yet. So how can we know if it exceeded $1 trillion, but yet that's a number that's being thrown around? The National Retail Federation says Americans haven't spent close to that amount. They should know. Holiday spending is instead on track to reach a combined $656 billion in November and December. And this is, again, according to the National Retail Federation. But yet, what are we hearing? We're going to hear all about the tweets and so forth where there was over $1 trillion of spending. Well, it's one thing to be optimistic. It's another thing to, encourage. But again, no, tell us the truth. That's what we want, is the truth, not hopes on something that's not going to happen. So again, it adds confusion, and I believe this is where, as much good as the new administration might do, it's information and releases like this that's going to cause a lot of volatility in the markets. It will add to the volatility in the market. So there was a couple of studies done back in, September. There was a study released by the, I can't remember who it was released by, but it was in September where they thought that the forecast for the holiday spending would exceed $1 trillion. You're always going to get that before the holiday season approaches because they do want to get people out there optimistic and in their spending. So, but you can't predict in September what the actual numbers are going to be. So we'll see what happens. The NRF is sticking to their estimate of $656 billion for the holiday season. And, the many people that I've spoken to around this country today, they don't feel like even the $656 billion might be a little optimistic because they thought it was a little quieter. And again, how do we know when you have all, you have all that online buying and so forth. So we always know the numbers are stronger than what they truly were. So again, be nice to get some real numbers once in a while, but I wouldn't expect that in the near future, Al, anytime soon.
Well, you never know. It's like the pony I've been waiting on for Christmas. I've been expecting that pony for some time. We may yet get it, Melody. You never know. It could happen, or maybe not. I got an article here from The Street. And the headline is, What highest credit card debt since 2008 crisis means for the U.S.? Americans now owe as much on their credit cards as in the fourth quarter before the 2008 financial crisis began. Their balances rose to $747 billion at the end of the year's third quarter, making up 6% of the $12.35 trillion in U.S. household debt. Question for economists is whether the surge in spending represents a justifiable optimism that consumers will benefit under the administration of President-elect Donald Trump, or if it's an early sign that shoppers lack the cash to buy necessities. What do you think, Melody? You think it's justifiable optimism going deeper into debt, credit card debt, or is it an early sign that shoppers lack the cash to buy necessities?
I'm not so sure it's a justifiable optimism, but we've seen what consumer confidence just did. So, yeah, there's optimism there. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And and I do believe it's also that the customers lack the cash to buy necessities. You can't tell me when insurance premiums are out there, health insurance premiums are jumping, 50, 60%, that there's a lot of cash to be had. You can't tell me when consumers are leasing instead of purchasing because the payments are lower, that there's a lot of cash to be had to buy holiday gifts and so forth, or just necessities. So yeah, I do believe it is the lack of cash that they have, and I also believe there is a some optimism.
I think,
out there.
It's both. There's it's, as you like to tell me, Melody. The answer is
I tried both. To say it a different
both,
way, Al.
Both. It's some people have optimism that may be justified, may not, and other people are just they're short on cash and they got to have something for Christmas or whatever. This actually reflects third quarter numbers. Doesn't reflect Christmas yet, but. Here's more of the story. It says, recent report by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York noted that credit card limits have increased for 15 consecutive quarters. Auto loan originations are at the highest level in 6 years. And student loan balances increased over the past 18 years. It's just another way of saying we're getting deeper and deeper and deeper into debt. And it goes on and says, right before the financial crisis in the fourth quarter of 2007, Average credit card household debt was $8,463, the highest since 1986. As of the third quarter of this year, household credit debt reached $7,941, missing the pre-recession mark by a little over $500. The highest we'd ever, right before the 2008 crisis, credit card debt was up to $8,500 per household. Now, right now, it's right about $8,000. That compares with household income, median household income of $56,000. And what that translates into, $7,000, $8,000 in credit card debt right now reflects about 14% of the $56,000 average income, household income in this country. This implies that the average household is not saving 5 or 10% a year. Instead, the average household is spending 14% more than their gross revenue. Instead of saving, say 10%, the average household is borrowing 14%, going deeper into debt by 14% of their gross income. And we're not talking about, this is money they're spending on top of. Their gross income is, again, $56,500. They're spending another $8,000 a year on top of that that they're borrowing to spend. Is this going to work out? According to one analyst, he said there's going to be a tipping point where household debt could become unsustainable. There'll be a point where people can't afford to make their minimum monthly payment. We think that will be in 2017 when we reach that unsustainable household debt level of around $8,400. So once again, we're headed for $8,400, at least according to one analyst's notion, in the same number basically that we saw prior to the 2008 financial crisis. All of which is just another way of saying, look, a lot of people are in debt. Can they all continue to repay the debt? And the answer is probably not, which means there's going to be a problem. No.
Yes, Melody? there's going to be a problem. And they will continue to use those credit cards. They've been doing it for a very long time. They're not going to stop and save money before they make their purchases. So, I mean, we've been in this mode of purchasing, this new way of purchasing, for a very long time. And if you want it, you get it, and you worry about paying for it later. And if you can't pay for it, hey, you just file bankruptcy and you move on. It's like there's no accountability anymore. I remember my grandfather, my heavens, they never even thought of not paying a bill. Yeah. I mean, you were going to, you know where, if you didn't make your payment, you didn't go into debt, you didn't buy things. And most of the listeners to this program, I mean, many of us are like that, we're going to make sure that we have the funds, we save up before we spend, and, we limit ourselves, we have a budget. But
some do, but a lot of people don't, and that's the message here. And there's going to be a problem that a lot of people are going to regret before this is done. We're going to take a break for a couple commercials. Melody and I will be right back. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom, and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks, I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. What's next, Melody?
I want to remind listeners to give us a call for all your gold and silver coin needs. We do have a limited amount and limited supply of quarter-ounce American Gold Eagles. These are quarter-ounce. Normally, they're priced higher than the 1 ounce because the smaller you go in the size of your gold content, the more you're going to pay for your gold. This is like $7 over what a Gold Eagle wholesale would be per quarter. So you're looking at $308 for a quarter ounce American Gold Eagle. These are older dates, so give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's $308 for a quarter ounce American Gold Eagle. 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com. Al.
Yes.
U.S. home values. I didn't see their number today. We were supposed to have new data today that should show pretty much more of the same in October. Prices growing at about 5% an annual clip for pretty much the past 2 years. And on paper, home price increases may have pretty much come full circle following, you know, the 2008, the Great Recession, or whatever you want to call it, the Great Depression. But these nominal price gains don't take into account the consumer price increases that inflate the home values over time. So in real terms, the index is still about 16% below the 2006 high. So a number of factors could make further price appreciation and possibly even a new inflation-adjusted high that much tougher to come by in the new year. So again, here's just another report that shows that if you really, you know, get down to the nuts and bolts of it, that the report just isn't what it seems when they say how great this is. And the market is flashing warning signs. The homeownership rate still hovers near a five-decade low, and it's tough for less affluent buyers to obtain mortgages. In the meantime, we have seen mortgage rates, they've risen substantially since the election. So again, that's going to have an effect on affordability in the upcoming years for the housing market. So here's another sector that's going to have issues. And so it seems to me, folks, that we might be at the peak of the best economy that we're going to have. But we'll see. I'm always optimistic. You know, you can always have a little bit of optimism there, but
you got to have realism too. I mean, that's one of the points to this program, why we do this, and at least what we think is real. And, you know, again, we focus a lot on the debt is unsustainable, too big to be paid, and the consequences of that are not good, and they won't be easily avoided, evaded, ignored. Sooner or later, that debt has to either be paid or it has to be repudiated. One of the two.
We can't just keep
pretending that we'll pay it someday. We'll leave it for the next generation and the next generation and the next. Sooner or later, a generation is going to have to pay the debt, and we're probably it.
We have a lot of people that are alive today. We have a lot of tough issues facing this country, and there's going to be a lot of fight with some of the changes that will be introduced. And so this, I think, will be part of the volatility that we face in 2017. And as I mentioned in the first segment of the program, we are looking at peaks in these markets. All the numbers are telling us we were going back to the times. And let's travel back in time. Do you feel as good today as you did in 2006? Do you feel as good today as you did in 1998?
And I'll How about 1970?
Well, no, I'm talking about when we've had these peaks in the market corrections and the condition of our economies. And I'll guarantee you the most listeners out there will say, no, it isn't the same today as it was in those peaks at those times. So, you know, it's going to be, you know, I think this is the year where a lot changes. You have Obamacare. There's another health cooperative, Evergreen Health Cooperative of Maryland, announced earlier that it's withdrawing from the Affordable Care Act exchanges next year, and it's leaving only five co-ops in the operation. After many months of working closely with Evergreen Management, leadership of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and outside investors to find a workable solution, so they've run out of time to meet the deadline for a January 1 effective date. We remain committed to a viable competitive insurance industry in Maryland. This comes from the insurance commissioner out of Maryland. So, yeah, they're going to feed you all the, you know, comforting words. Oh, yeah, real competitive. My insurance rates went up 61%. That's real competitive. But this action is going to force 6,000 customers serviced by the co-op to be automatically enrolled in new plans. So how much do you think those new plans are going to cost? I'll guarantee you they're going to be higher. And the co-op was awarded $65 million in taxpayer-funded loans in 2012. Of the 23 co-ops originally created under Obamacare, 18 have failed. That's a huge number.
Yeah, I know.
It's a huge number.
The majority of them.
The majority of them have failed. By design, I believe it was, you know, by design, but
I don't think it was by design. I think they thought they could force it through one way or another, but I think it goes to show what happens when you have a government that's run by people that are ideologues rather than pragmatists. And what I mean by that is there's people up here that there were people in the Obama administration who believed in a certain left-wing philosophy. And they thought they could, being the masters of the universe in Washington, D.C., they could make things happen. They could defy reality. And you get somebody like Trump who might be a pragmatist. You know, some idea of how much blood you can squeeze out of a turnip. And it might be much, but if there's any at all, Trump has an idea of how much you can get out of a turnip. It's part of the way he does his deals. Right, he's not getting caught up in ideology, or at least that's possible. It's too early to say that for an absolute fact, but he's not caught up in ideology so much as he's just a pragmatist. I'm going to do the best I can for the people that I represent right now and the entity I represent, which is the government of the United States. So perhaps we're seeing the difference. The ideologues, they went too far. They didn't understand that their philosophy had limits. Pragmatists, they understand the limits more clearly, and perhaps they can generate a better result. We'll see. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but it's a possibility. But when you're talking about the markets right now and the number of indices that are near record highs, at or near record highs, it reminds me of the contrarian investment strategy, which is you buy, you know, the idea that you buy low and you sell high. Which means you buy when things are pessimistic. People say, oh, that's no good. You can't get anything out of that investment anymore. And that's the time to buy. And the time to sell is when everybody says, happy days are here again. If the contrarian philosophy is correct, and I believe it is, it has to be. You buy low, you sell high. It means when you see this extraordinary optimism and you see record highs, it is a good indication that that's the time to sell. How many record highs are we going to get? And it's not impossible that the record high, if we've got a 20,000 Dow, it could go to 21,000. I can't tell you that's impossible, but the odds are we're going to get maybe a little closer to that 20,000. Maybe we'll get over the 20,000. But at that point in time, I think we can expect that the market is going to begin to drop. Time, buy low, sell high. Now's a high point. You're hitting records. You're hitting record highs. You have to ask yourself, how many more records can we hit? And it could hit more. That's not impossible. But the probability is we are going to see markets fall. And if we do, then, you know, if you want to make a profit, buy low, sell high. Now's the time to be selling. We'll watch and see whether that turns out to be valid, whether that those recommendations, those observations turn out to be valid or not. But I'm going to bet you that they basically are.
Well, I'm just going to go back a moment to Obamacare, because I do think it was by design. They knew darn well it was created. They knew it wouldn't work. I believe they stuck it in there. You have so many problems with the healthcare industry, Medicare, Medicaid, and now you got taxpayers paying for it, forced to pay for it, premiums increasing, and whether it was just kicking the can down the road, but we all know government wants a one-payer system. So they're going to get us there sooner or later. And this is pretty much where we're heading. And, you know, man, there's arguments for it and against it. You know, just, you know, you can talk to, you know, some Canadians and they love it. Other Canadians dislike it. So, but no, I definitely believe it was a bandage. I believe it was all done by design. This was their last attempt. And they got them a couple of years on this health care because the health care system is imploding. And there's so much corruption and everything else going on in the healthcare industry. It's just not, and to sell it across states just to make it competitive, I mean, it's going to be complicated to fix, and there's no going back. So
I don't know that there's no going back. I think one of the most dangerous things we can do is accept the idea. And anytime government creates a program, if it doesn't work, the solution to the problem is to spend more money on the program. Maybe the solution is, if it doesn't work, can it? Kill it. Be done with it. Don't tinker with it. Right? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. If it is broke, let it go. We see program after program where, oh, we just throw some more money at it. Then it'll be all right. Where's that money coming from? You know, we're coming to a time when you're not going to have, it's going to be obvious and apparent to everyone and undeniable, we don't have enough money to do everything we'd like to do, everything we've promised to do, and the question will be, okay, where do we start to cut?
So what are you going to replace it with?
I don't know that you're going to replace it.
You're not going to
replace
healthcare?
Maybe you're going to replace it with personal responsibility and say, look, I'm sorry, but we don't have enough money to fund this thing. People are going to be personally responsible for your own healthcare.
That's fine. What programs are there?
I'm not saying there should be a program.
What programs are there to go
program
to?
Program is open your wallet and pay the bill. You know, I mean, one of the things that is almost certain to happen here, I've talked about this before, back before Texas had mandatory automobile insurance. You get repairs done on your car very reasonably. Well, they were cheap. But once they made mandatory insurance, the automobile repairman, They just raised their prices because nobody cared. I don't care. Charge me $500. Charge me $5,000. What do I care if the insurance company's paying? The same thing to some extent is true with this big insurance program for medicine.
I agree, Al, if you can't pay for your health insurance. I mean, there used to be community hospitals. There were other things that people could go to for care and so forth. If they were ill, they could take care of themselves. There was things that they could do. And, you know, you did have Medicare, you did have Medicaid were some of the programs. So how do you get a competitive price for the people who do want health insurance? And I know there's some wonderful Christian programs out there, wonderful Christians programs where they're in a group and they pay and it seems to be working. I suppose more programs should be set up like that, maybe even corporations, businesses.
And I think the programs you're talking about are where everyone, 100 of us or 1,000 of us or however many join in this particular insurance program, and we guarantee, we pledge to pay whatever the debts are at the end of the year. And if none of us get sick, then we don't have to pay anything. And if we all get sick, we have to pay quite a lot. But we assume personal responsibility for paying under those programs. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's great. Yeah. I think some of those programs, they have worked. Yeah. You know, we have aging population. You know, we're kind of forced to go on to Medicare when we reach 65 and so forth. So, you know, it takes a little bit of stress off those types of programs for the aging population. I mean, there are some things that you can do However, we have insurance commissioners all across this country. We still have state governments. So it's just not a matter of changing, you know, from the White House down. You have states and so forth. I mean it's a complicated process, not done overnight. I think it would take years. And you know, so the question is, would the system collapse prior to a lot of these new programs coming into effect? And I've spent 12, 13 years in the insurance business. It's been a while. Maybe things are easier than what they were 25, 30 years ago, 35 years ago. Highly unlikely that it's easier. So,
well, the question isn't whether it's hard or easy exactly. The question is, can the insurance companies actually pay the bills? Can we afford the premiums? And if we can, are the premiums affordable? And if they are, can the insurance companies afford the bills? And if they're not, either we go to the hospitals less frequently, or the hospitals have to cut their costs.
It would be great to have redesigned insurance policies. Redesign them. Let us have options. For many years I carried catastrophic coverage only. I only wanted if I, you know, had a heart attack or had cancer or something, you know, if I chose to go that route for my medical attention. I had $10,000-$15,000 deductibles. I paid for my own, you know, checkups if I, you know, whatever. You know, I wrote a check for it. That's how I think it should be.
Well, I agree.
I think there should only be catastrophic losses out there.
Policies. That may be true. That might be a good recommendation. You can't go to the hospital every time you stub your toe, or at least expect the rest of the world to pay for it. If you stub your toe, that's on you. If you have cancer, that's another story. Maybe we can all afford to kick in to help you if you have cancer. If you have a stroke, maybe we can all kick in. Mm-hmm. Got a little broken wrist, broken finger, that's your problem. And it's a little like that with the deductibles. I mean, that's the idea behind deductibles. If your bill is less than X number of dollars, you pay it and it doesn't get charged to the government. But maybe that has to be expanded. Maybe the deductible has to be increased to where instead of having a $500 or even a $5,000, maybe it's got to be a $10,000 deductible. Maybe we have to be responsible for the first $10,000 or more of our medical bills, and after that, we'll have some sort of an insurance agency.
The deductible should only apply to hospital visits, you know, out-of-pocket expenses should be out-of-pocket expenses. But anyway, I'm not a health, you know, insurance expert. Discussions here, and but something has to be done. But
well, something's going to be done because it can't be afforded. That's okay. The fundamental point. Obamacare isn't good. That's a fundamental point. I don't think we can afford Obamacare, and that means one way or another it's going to go. Whether it goes easy, goes hard, we don't know, but it's going to have to go because it can't be afforded in its current form, in its current, you know, manifestation. Let's take a break for a couple commercials. Melody and I will be back on Financial Survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival. What's next, Melody?
Well, I just thought this was an interesting. The U.S. government is loaning millions of dollars to jumpstart urban farming. Every year since 2013, the U.S. Department of Agriculture devotes millions of dollars to farmers in rural areas. The government is increasingly starting to offer assistance to urban farms also. In 2016, the USDA funded a dozen urban farms. This is the highest number in history.
Did you say a dozen or dozens?
The USDA funded a dozen urban farms, the highest number in history. In 2017, this is Val Dolcini, the administrator for the USDA Farm Services, told Business Insider. In 2017, he expects the USDA to funnel even more money toward farms on rooftops, in greenhouses, and in warehouses. The USDA microloans, a program that offers funding up to $50,000, is specifically geared toward urban farmers. It was established in 2013, as I mentioned, and the program has awarded 23,000 loans worth $518 million to farms in California, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. Though it's open to all farmers, urban farmers often apply for it because it offers the money on a smaller scale. 70%, or about a little over 16,000 of these loans, have gone to new farmers, many of them in cities.
How many of them do you think know anything about farming?
Well, probably very little. I don't know. You could live in a city and know, you know, you can. There's a lot of co-op little greenhouses popping up.
A lot of people growing marijuana. You know, there's a lot of people growing marijuana. They're farmers, Melody.
Well, they could be.
Maybe they can apply for a loan from the government.
Maybe that's what these are. Because I did in California, Massachusetts. Didn't they approve marijuana? But I just find it interesting, and I thought,
Well, it's actually kind of a good idea. I've seen reports, and I can't quote the exact number of miles, but the average person's vegetables in this country are coming from 400 or 500 miles away from where he lives. There's something to be said for growing your broccoli and carrots and whatever locally, instead of hauling it several hundred miles to get to your grocery store. Maybe if it were possible to grow adequate crops under, you know, aquaculture, hydroponics, whatever, maybe it's possible to grow enough vegetables to make an impact on where your vegetables come from in your local community. You know, it used to be that grocery stores, when I was a kid, the majority of the grocery store was a warehouse. And they ordered food that came in by semi-truckloads, a truckload full of Campbell beans and another truckload full of potato chips or whatever. And they stored it out in the warehouse, and they brought it in and put it on the shelves where the customers could come in, the smaller part of the facility. But everything was in the back room. Today, it's just-in-time delivery system where they monitor everything, and they know when to bring in more potato chips and broccoli and whatever else. And they bring it in just-in-time. They don't store anything behind the... there's no warehouse behind the grocery store. and there's no margin for error. If anything breaks down, there's a problem. What if we started creating grocery stores that sold that little front area where they sell the broccoli and the carrots and the kale and whatever else they've got up there? And in the back, where they used to have a warehouse, they had an aquaculture system or a hydroponic system, and they were growing the vegetables right there as part of the grocery store. The grocery store got away from, the grocer could get away from whatever it costs to have those vegetables brought in by truck. That cost could be avoided. Maybe that's a good idea.
That's what I mentioned. I find it interesting because it's going into cities to where perhaps they're having difficulties with produce. It would be something. But, you know, I don't agree that government should be loaning $518 million to people to on a rooftop to when all they really need is some dirt and seeds.
So, maybe all you need
you
is
know,
water.
I mean, so again, I don't, you know. That's just how I feel. But
well, you know, when the government gets involved, they stick their thumb in everything everyone does as if they're going to help. You know, we're here to help you. We hear about it all the time. We joke about it all the time, or at least on a regular basis. Government is here to help you. I don't know if that's true or false. I don't even know if they really intend to help people, but maybe we'd be better off if government just kind of left us alone. All right, just go back to Washington, do whatever you want to do back there, but leave us alone down here in Texas or Maryland or wherever you happen to be. Leave us alone to run our own lives, and maybe we could grow our own vegetables without you people creating regulations that wind up bringing our vegetables in from a couple hundred miles away. I go to a Chinese grocery store once in a while, all right? And they have some, whoever's running these grocery stores, they know something about vegetables. Because the vegetables, I believe they are more flavorful than what I can get down at Tom Thumb, for example. They may not look as perfect, but there's something about them that appeals to me. But, you know, I'm not absolutely certain. I don't know where those vegetables are coming from. Somebody knows how to raise vegetables. I don't know who it is. I don't know if they're bringing those vegetables in from Mexico or if they're bringing them in from some plant that's just down the road or if they're flying them all the way in from China. You know, we get pineapples flown in from Hawaii, or at least we used to. I'm not sure if Hawaii's still flying them in, but I think they are flying them in. It's airfare is cheap enough where you can move pineapples by air. Now, is it cheap enough where you can move vegetables from China all the way over here to the United States? And do we really want to be buying Chinese vegetables? I don't know. I would feel more comfortable thinking that my vegetables were being grown at a little factory, a little facility that was a mile down the street from where I'm living, and I could stop in and see it once in a while, or I could buy the groceries directly from the front office of that facility where they're growing the vegetables, and maybe take a tour once in a while and see how they're going, how they grow the fruit, how they grow the vegetables. I think that would please me. I'd like that. I would have more confidence in what I was purchasing.
This company called Arrow Farms in 2016. It's the world's largest vertical farm. They launched inside a 70,000 square foot warehouse in Newark, New Jersey. There's a Brooklyn-based urban farming company, Gotham Greens. They opened the world's largest rooftop farm in Chicago in the late 2015. So, I mean, these are certainly a little bit larger than just having a little bit of dirt and seeds, but it's kind of fascinating to see how the farming is taking on a whole new face, and I think it's part of the future. I mean, the gasoline.
There's a lot of people that are
unemployed. Well, that's true.
And there's a lot of labor required in harvesting vegetables. There's a certain amount of labor. I don't know that it's a lot, but it would be possible in the context of urban environments to hire people that are otherwise unemployed to help take care of the vegetables and help pick the cabbage when the cabbage is ripe and dispose of the root system when you're done with it. And,
yeah, illegal aliens live in big cities too.
I know. I understand that.
Anyway,
maybe some farmers who used to have farms out in the rural America, they've gone broke, and who knows, they may have emigrated to the urban communities, and they've said, hey, look, maybe I could run a farm here in downtown Dallas.
Then these farms, once they're up and running, can be bought out by Monsanto.
If they're profitable.
And, you know,
if they're not profitable, they could be subsidized by the government.
So anyway, it's interesting. There's all kinds of possibilities where that can go. But certainly these inner cities, to me it was lacking food, lacking produce.
Innovative. It's the sort of thing. I've followed this a little bit. I've watched all these hydroponic setups where they can grow X number of vegetables and cabbages and the vegetables. I would follow it a little bit. I'm not an expert on it. But I can see that this is a pretty good idea, growing your vegetables locally, right? Endeavoring to grow them locally. There's something going on here. I think it's positive. I think if you can minimize government involvement, it's a good thing they're lending money, but are they also imposing regulations? Will the money get these things started? Will the regulations make them stop? All right, you want to lend some money, get these guys up and going, fine. Want to regulate them out of business? That's not a good idea.
I also wonder, though, you have the warehouse, 70,000 square foot warehouse. Plants need sun. You can reproduce the light, mm-hmm. To allow them to grow, but are you still getting the nutrients from the sun and so forth?
Well, the question is more the nutrients in the soil or the water that are feeding the plants, and that's mm-hmm. part of the problem. You can grow all kinds of plants that look like there's something edible and healthy and the rest of that, and in fact they know how to put the right chemicals to the plants. They give them fertilizers that make them look healthy, right? But it's like feeding steroids to muscle builders, right? Well, yeah, you can get some enormous muscles and rest, that sort of thing, but I'm not sure. They're certainly not natural. They may not be healthy. I'm not sure how strong they really are. But if you can find a way to grow natural food, right, in a way that's healthy as much as possible, and at a local level where people are involved and they have an involvement, they say, well, listen, this would be better if we used these supplements, minerals, whatever, in order to fertilize the plants, maybe we could get a better quality plant. I'm talking about the consumers maybe having a little input on how this stuff is growing. So it's something to look for, something to hope for. I'd just soon buy my vegetables from a warehouse down the street that was growing them under artificial light as from a major corporation that was located 500 miles away. So, Harvey, how much space you got, Melody? Can we start growing some vegetables in your backyard?
Sure, I'll apply for a loan.
I know you had some tomatoes out there because you sent me some in the mail.
God's tomatoes.
Yeah, you sent me.
Yeah, I didn't plant them. They just came up. They were little tomatoes.
It's a miracle, Melody.
Tomato. Yeah, it is. Huh? All God's plants are miracles. You betcha. Growing number of Americans are retiring outside of the United States. In many cases, they're looking for a way to stretch their retirement. The percent of American retirees living abroad rose 17% between 2010 and 2015. This is from the Social Security Administration. Says there are just under 400,000 American retirees living elsewhere. What's interesting is the countries that they choose. Canada, Japan, Mexico, Germany, and the United Kingdom. I would think Germany and the United Kingdom would be expensive to live. I don't know about. I would think Japan.
Japan is certain. I'm going to assume historically it's been expensive. Maybe it's not so much anymore, but it has been in the past.
But I mean, it's hard to believe that they would be less expensive than the United States.
Yeah, they're going for other reasons.
Now, Mexico, yes. Yep. Canada,
bring your snowshoes.
You know.
There's other reasons. They've got family. They think they're freer there. Or there's less government oppression, or who knows what they think. But you're not going to Germany to save money. I don't believe that. And certainly, and if you, you know, and I don't believe there are people living on Social Security who've emigrated to Germany or even the United Kingdom. Probably not Japan. if you got enough money, you're pretty well fixed. Yeah, maybe like Germany, been there before, and maybe like Japan. But I don't know.
But I find it interesting that those were the countries that the Social Security Administration says that the countries that they've chosen, because that's where their checks go. So I would think that they would have an idea. Now, a lot of them, they have problems. You know, of course, Medicare doesn't reach them, you know, in another country, and accessing health care in some of these other places might be a little difficult. But if you're healthy,
you can go to Cuba.
You can go to Cuba.
Cuba has cheap health care. Cheap, yeah, it's one of the things that the government may be advising in order to cut costs. We're going to have to cut your Social Security, ladies and gentlemen, because the government's in a bind. But in order to make things easy, we've decided to take you retirees, and we're going to move you to Cuba, all right? And you can enjoy life in the Cuban Democratic Republic. And we'll see if you enjoy it or you don't, but at least it'll be cheap to live there.
And let's see what else is going on. We're just about out
seconds.
Of time. 30 seconds. 1-800-375-4188. $308 for a quarter ounce American Gold Eagle. Supplies are limited. As long as we can offer them to you at that price, we will. And pick yourself up some Silver Eagles. The wholesalers tried to increase the premiums on 2016 Silver Eagles, but there was enough of complaints.
Backlash.
Yes, that they decided not to, and they couldn't. So,
well, maybe later. All right, folks, we're out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Todd, the producer.
Bye bye.
To pay. Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.